לתשומת ליבכם, התוכנית הבאה היא תוכנית מוקלטת, ועשויות להישמע במהלכה התראות והתייחסות לאירועים ביטחוניים שהראו בזמן שידורה הראשון. האזנה טובה.
You are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and Shavua Tov. This is Mark Weiss with a roundup of the top news stories at this hour on day 183 of the war against Hamas. 47-year-old hostage Elad Katsir has been killed in captivity in Gaza. His body was rescued in an overnight raid in Khan Yunis and brought to Israel. Katsir was kidnapped from kibbutz near Oz, where he worked in agriculture. On January the 8th, the Islamic Jihad published a video featuring Katsir. It is believed he was murdered in January. His sister, Karamit Paltry Katsir, blamed the Israeli government for abandoning him. He could have been rescued if the deal had happened on time. Our leadership is cowardly and is driven by political considerations, so it didn't happen, she wrote on Facebook. The Hostages and Missing Families Forum said that Elad Katsir was held alive by Hamas for 3 months, during which signs of life were given and reports of his condition reached Israel. 3 months in which there was a possibility of saving him and returning him alive to his family and country. The forum said the recovery of his body is a painful, immediate and difficult reminder that time is running out for the hostages. There is no time for negotiations, no time for power struggles and no time for global diplomacy. Sirens sounded in northern communities this afternoon, warning of incoming rockets. Alarms were triggered in Dafna, Goshrim, Kfar Solt, Sha'ar Yashuv, Beit Hillel, Amir and Stein Chamia. There were no reports of injuries or damage. Border police officers arrested Saturday afternoon a 17-year-old Palestinian residing illegally in Israel who was allegedly plotting to carry out a stabbing attack. The teenager, a resident of Bir Zeit, north of Ramallah, was arrested near Jerusalem Old City's Damascus Gate after raising the suspicions of border police. He had a large knife strapped to his body. The army reported in a joint statement with the Israel security agency Shin Bet today that its forces killed Akram Abed al-Rahman Hassan Salameh, a senior Hamas security official who also acted as deputy municipal leader in Khan Yunis. According to the statement, he was killed in an airstrike in southern Gaza. Separate demonstrations are taking place tonight in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Caesarea, close to the Prime Minister's house, and other locations, calling for new elections and for a deal to release the hostages. Hamas is sending a delegation to ceasefire and hostage release talks in Cairo tomorrow. U.S. President Joe Biden on Friday wrote to the leaders of Egypt and Qatar, calling on them to press Hamas for a hostage deal with Israel. The letters to Egyptian President al-Sisi and Qatar's ruling emir, Sheikh Afani, came as Biden sent CIA Director William Burns to Cairo for talks this weekend, even though Hamas has rejected the latest compromise proposals. Official American sources told CBS News that the Iranian retaliation to the Israeli-attributed assassination of a Revolutionary Guards general in Damascus is expected to take place at some point in the coming week. Iran has placed its forces on high alert, and a decision has been made that Iran must respond directly to the Damascus attack in order to create deterrence, according to two Iranian officials quoted by the New York Times. CNN reports that the U.S. is on high alert and actively preparing for a significant attack that could come as soon as within the next week by Iran targeting Israeli or American assets in the region, a senior administration official told CNN. Senior American and Israeli officials currently believe that the attack from Iran is inevitable. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong said that the information provided by Israel regarding the death of the Australian citizen, one of the seven World Central Kitchen volunteers killed in Gaza, is insufficient. She said, we have not yet received sufficient information that meets our expectations. That's the news. Now a look at some of the main stories in the news this week. This is Mark Weiss from Jerusalem.
You are listening to the English language news of Kan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening and Shavua Tov. This is Mark Weiss with a look at some of this week's top news stories. Officials who are well informed of the details of the incident in which seven World Central Kitchen volunteers were killed in the Gaza Strip said that the vehicle in which they were riding had been attacked from the air because it had been mistakenly identified as carrying armed men, probably because of the security guards that accompanied the passengers. The IDF said that the inquiry into the incident would be completed in the next few days and its findings would be presented to the public. U.S. Secretary of Defense Austin spoke to Defense Minister Gallant and expressed his outrage and urged him to conduct a swift and transparent inquiry and to share the conclusions publicly and to hold those responsible to account. IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said he spoke with the founder of World Central Kitchen and expressed his deepest condolences. In an English language statement, he said that the IDF is conducting a deep and transparent probe.
Last night, an incident took place in Gaza that resulted in the tragic death of World Central Kitchen employees as they fulfilled their vital mission of bringing food to people in need. As a professional military committed to international law, we are committed to examining our operations thoroughly and transparently. I just spoke to WCK founder Chef Jose Anders and expressed the deepest condolences of Israel Defense Forces to the families and the entire World Central Kitchen family. We also express sincere sorrow to our allied nations who have been doing and continue to do so much to assist those in need. We have been reviewing the incident in the highest levels to understand the circumstances of what happened and how it happened. We will be opening a probe to examine this serious incident further. This will help us reduce the risk of such an event from occurring again. The incident will be investigated in the fact-finding and assessment mechanism. an independent professional and expert body. For the last few months, the IDF has been working closely with the World Central Kitchen to assist them in fulfilling their noble mission of helping bring food and humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. WCK also came to help Israelis after the massacre of October 7th. They were one of the first NGOs here. The work of WCK is critical. They are the front lines of humanity. We will get to the bottom of this and we will share our findings transparently.
IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. IDF Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, a senior fellow at the FDD, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and a former international spokesperson for the IDF, says the IDF's acceptance of responsibility for the killing of the aid workers in Gaza needs to be followed up with a transparent inquiry and also possible accountability. At the same time, he says he does not believe that the incident could torpedo Israel's war against Hamas. Conricus told reporter Ari O'Sullivan that the dichotomy of the tragic mistaken killing of the aid workers in Gaza, juxtaposed with a highly accurate strike against top Iranian generals in Damascus, according to foreign reports, and was a challenge for the image of the IDF.
There's a challenge here because in the same 24 hours, Israel reportedly conducted a very successful and accurate strike against Iranian terrorists in Damascus and also caused a very sad loss of life and effectively killed seven international aid workers. And the contrast between the two events is, of course, striking. The IDF will have to do a few things quickly in order to, shall we say, get out of trouble. Two things have already been done. One is to take responsibility for the action and to say, this is us, this is our doing, no ifs and buts, not Hamas, not let us see what happened and let us investigate. But first and foremost, it is our doing. Second thing is to apologize, and we are in the good stages of that. And you see senior commanders, the chief of staff himself in person in English in the middle of the night after he oversaw parts of the after-action review, the investigation, addressing the topic, and that's positive. Third thing, which has not happened yet and needs to happen as quickly as possible, is to show a very transparent and easy-to-understand result of the after-action review, of the investigation. So to investigate is not enough, but actually to show the investigation. And then I think that this time the level of anger, resentment, and really what's on the scale here, probably the IDF will have to consider, the commanders in the IDF will have to consider accountability. Secretary Kirby, or the spokesperson Kirby for the security...
the Pentagon.
Yeah, for the Pentagon, he mentioned accountability, and I think not by mistake. And I think that in this case, I don't think that it will be enough for the IDF to say, listen, we investigated, this is what happened, we're sorry, and this is what we will do to make sure that it doesn't happen again. Those are all good things that need to happen. I'm not sure that it will be enough, and I think that the IDF would be smart in preempting additional pressure on the IDF by investigating, showing the investigation graphically, very clearly, and then also saying this is the disciplinary measures that are going to be taken against the person who was accountable for what happened.
Let's have a look at how the Army Spokesman Unit handled this. I mean, way back when, 28, 29 years ago, there was the Operation Grapes of Wrath, and Kfar Kana was a mistakenly fired cannon fire artillery round that ended up killing many civilians. It ended up torpedoing the whole Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
And my question is, I mean, these sort of things are sort of inevitable in wars. Was there a procedure inside the, let's say, the spokesman's office on how to deal with something like this?
Yeah, there is a procedure. It's called dealing with a communication crisis, where the first part is to understand that you are indeed in a crisis situation. That's imperative, which doesn't always happen. It may sound obvious to people around the world, but it doesn't actually always happen like that. But the IDF spokesperson unit did. And the thing that the protocol is, okay, this happened. We are now in crisis mode. Priority number one is to get access to verified information and understand what happened, which in a chaotic environment like war, in urban terrain with lots of civilians and terrorists and troops in the air, on the ground, at sea, underground, and each one of them firing and with capabilities to cause damage, then the first and biggest challenge for the IDF is to understand what happened. And after you're able to ascertain what happened, then, of course, as quickly as possible, formulate your strategy as to how are you going to tackle this? What is the main message?
Yeah.
And in this case, it's, I think, rather clear, and I think what the IDF spokesperson, Admiral Hagari, did was exactly what was needed to address the world in rather clear English and to say, we are sorry, this is our doing, it was not intentional, and we are now investigating it, and rest assured that we take this extremely seriously, and to show that. And I think it's very important that the chief of staff did the same thing and added also in English in a very authentic and important message. But we have to go, you know, the protocol here is many times it kind of falls short in the sense of, okay, we've done that, now let's move on. I'm not sure that in this specific crisis, almost half a year after the war started, and with the amount of international pressure on Israel that is mounting by the day, and the political complications and the reported situation between Jerusalem and Washington and many other things, I'm not sure that the usual protocol will be enough. And you spoke about Kfar Kana in, 25 or more than so years ago, almost 40 years, sorry. That was before social media,
yes.
And that was before smartphones and many other things that are basically that accelerate the pace and the intensity of everything that happens on the battlefield and off the battlefield. So I wish, you know, we were in a situation of that media landscape, much easier, slower, simpler. Today is media on steroids, and a unit like the IDF has to operate extremely quickly under tremendous pressure and, of course, get things right. There's no tolerance for a unit like the IDF, spokesperson unit, to get things wrong and to present data that isn't verified. That's an important thing to keep in mind.
Absolutely. Do you think this could torpedo the continuation of this war?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is a significant event. It has strategic ramifications, but I think that there is enough goodwill and diplomatic ability to do what's most important here, is to get these organizations back on track. That's what Israel should focus on. That's what I'm sure the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Prime Minister's office and anybody else who has an ability to reach out to these organizations, the capitals around the world, what should be priority number one, and I'm sure that it is get them back working, make sure that they are safe, have procedures in place, and show them the international, those organizations, as well as the leaders and the media. Show that you're now taking different steps in order to make sure that it won't happen again, because it is of strategic importance to get these organizations back in action. If they don't, that is a game changer, could be a game changer for Israel. I don't think that it will happen because there are human lives here at stake. And if civilians, if these organizations will stop providing food and assistance, then the civilians will suffer. And I think that the aid organizations don't want to do that. But Israel must facilitate and facilitate it quickly and clearly that it is safe for international organizations, aid organizations to operate in Gaza, and that we will be taking extra precautions with these organizations and their personnel and their facilities in the future in order to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and a former international spokesperson for the IDF. Professor Eyal Zissa, an expert on Syria and Iran from Tel Aviv University, said that the killing alleged by Israel of Iranian General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, along with his deputy in Damascus, was a message that Israel will go after Iranians anywhere in the world who encourage and support attacks on Israel. Zissa told reporter Ari O'Sullivan that the Iranians don't have the military capabilities to strike Israel without Hezbollah or proxies like the Houthis in Yemen.
It's significant because he was really a serious target. I mean, after Soleimani, Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the Americans in January 20, he's the most top high-ranking Iranian general that was killed either by Israel or by the United States. And he was behind the building up of Hezbollah during the last two, three decades and the Iranian efforts to establish Iranian presence on Syrian soil. So he was very significant.
So was this a target to him, or is this a message, or is both?
I think it's both. I mean, on the one hand, it's a major setback for the Iranians. It's a clear message from Israel, although Israel didn't take responsibility for the airstrike, that it's not anymore that Iran can use and operate and send its proxies to hit Israel, either it's Hamas or Hezbollah or the Shiite militia in Iraq. But now Israel will go after the Iranians. After the Iranians who are on the ground in Syria, in Lebanon, and who are those who actually encourage and support those attacks against Israel. So it's also some sort of a message.
Well, even if it's a consulate inside the middle of an Arab capital.
It's not an Arab capital, it's Damascus, and it's a base for the Iranian that was used to deliver weapon. And so it's not a neutral country in Western Europe. And let me remind you that, you know, the Iranians are those who try and hit, you know, Israeli embassies and Israeli diplomats. So they are the last to complain that diplomatic, although it's not a diplomatic, you know, it's the Revolutionary Guard, it's a military base of the Revolutionary Guard, it's well known, the fact that those generals were there, so it's not out of the blue, and it's not an illegitimate target.
I want to get back to the General Zahedi. I understand from media reports that he was helping the Assad regime put down the civil war there. He was very close to Hezbollah. Did he have any role in sort of what's going on in Jordan now, the rioting that's happening in Jordan?
I don't know. I mean, he was responsible mainly for the military dimension of the conflict. I mean, building up the military force of Hezbollah, supplying Hezbollah and others with weaponry system, was he also involved in politics? And that's, I really don't know.
This is probably one of the most top killings or assassinations since Qasem Soleimani, yes?
Yes, it's not one of, it's the most, yes, because as far as the Iranian concern, as far as the Iranian generals are concerned, he was the most important, significant, yes.
Well, Tehran has vowed to respond, but I want to ask you a question. I don't know if I know you're an Arab affairs expert, but a little bit of strategy in Israel's side. Is the present situation one where Israel has a greater reign of action because it knows any heavier retaliation by Hezbollah or Iran would mean total war?
I mean, they already, it's not that they retaliate, they on a daily basis attack Israel along the border.
Along the border, though, they don't attack Haifa or rest of Israel.
Yes, this is correct, but And I guess that if the Iranians could do it, they have, but they don't have the military capabilities. They can use, they don't want to use Hezbollah because they are afraid of a total war, and they don't want to do it themselves. So what they do is to use Iraqi or Yemeni factions. Yes, proxies, factions like what happened in Eilat. So that's what they can do, and I guess that if they had better abilities, they would have used them. But that's what they have.
Do you think Israelis can sleep more soundly now?
It's a war, ongoing war, although it's a limited war along the northern border. And during the war, I do suggest that everybody will be not awakened, in full alert.
How do you think the Arab world is looking at this? Let's say the leadership, not so much the public.
I think they are happy because the Iranians are not allies and not friends of the Arabs. And it's quite clear that the Arabs were targets before and will become targets. The moderate pro-Western Arab regime will become targets for the Arab, for the Iranians after the war come to an end. So why should they be sorry for what happened? On the contrary, they would have expected the Americans to do it, but for the last decade, America refrained from being too aggressive toward Iran.
Professor Eyal Zissa, an expert on Syria and the Middle East from Tel Aviv University. Now, Ehud Banai with Something Stirring. Matril Mitorer.
התורה בפתח בית הכנסת הגדול ברחוב שדל 5 מאות שנשמעים צלילים של סמבה בהופעה חיה מתערבבים במחשבות על אורן סוף ההוויה כאן שמעתי לפני 42 שנה את הרב מספר על העובר ברחם אמו מקצה העולם ועד קצה הוא עטוף באולטרסאונד של רחמים משהו רדום מתחיל זינגלה ממועדון בודג הטרון לבית מדרש בתל ברוך האחראי על המקום אמר שהוא מחפש גנן אמרתי לו שאני לגמרי בעניין בזמן שהם ישבו בפנים עם הגמרא אני בחוץ ניקשתי עשבים בזמן שהם נגנו על הבמה שמעתי קול קורא בין הצלילים
1980
משהו רדום מתחיל
בספר ההקדמות של הרב אשלג יש משל על מלך שמזמין את כל העם לארמון ומעמיד על הדרך מכשולים קשים צריך התעקשות גדולה רק מעטים זוכים 42 שנה מנקש ומתעקש עדיין בחצר לא בטרקלין הפנימי בפתח בית הכנסת הגדול מחוץ לשער בהמתנה לדבר האמיתי משהו
Arab states reportedly expressed willingness before the United States to deploy Arab forces in the West Bank in addition to the Gaza Strip as part of a day-after plan for the Gaza war. The position was conveyed in a meeting between Arab foreign ministers with their American counterpart in Cairo earlier this month. An informed Arab diplomat told Khan that the condition for such a deployment is that it be in the framework of security arrangements to launch a peace process and implement a two-state solution. Reserve Brigadier General Yossi Kupavasa, a former head of the IDF Intelligence Analysis Branch and Director General of the Ministry of International Affairs and Strategy, said that deploying foreign forces in Gaza was feasible, but unlikely.
There is a feasibility for that sort of thing, but I'm not sure that there's a possibility for that sort of thing. Mm. Because, I doubt if these countries will dare to enter Gaza before they are totally confident that nothing bad is going to happen to their forces if they're, once they are deployed over there. And as long as Hamas is still holding some ability to influence the situation in Gaza, there's no way for them to enter.
Well, when people talk about thinking about the day after, sort of the day after this war, what forces could control Gaza?
I think the overall security responsibility for Gaza should be in the hands of the IDF. Mm-hmm. Nobody else can do the job for us. And that means also that we should have to be deployed along the border with Egypt, and that we should have to be deployed, of course, along the border with Israel. But overall responsibility for security would mean that we should be able to enter wherever we need to enter in order to foil the terror threats emanating from the Gaza Strip. And this is what it means. And the presence of foreign forces would be quite complicating the situation, in my mind, if this is going to happen. Although there can be some arrangements, just as we have in Lebanon with UNIFIL and so on and so forth. But it can happen, but we have to understand the contribution of these forces to security is going to be limited. They can be employed in internal security for whoever mm-hmm. is going to rule Gaza and needs some guards in order to enable it to function. Then these forces can have a role in that.
But I'm sure it also could create a challenge for Israeli forces if we get into a conflict with them, no?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It's, they could have only some limited, very limited and very well-defined protection missions for all the Gazans that are going to be involved in ruling Gaza in the day after. If there's any need for that. But it's complicated anyhow. Even that is going to be complicated.
I want to ask you a little bit about the Rafah and the Egyptians. The Egyptians are very fearful that there will be sort of a spillover of the Palestinian and Gazans into northern Sinai. There were reports last week that the Egyptians were asking the Americans to find out what the Israeli IDF plan is on Rafah because they are afraid that there will be hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from Gaza moving into northern Sinai.
Of course the Egyptians are worried about this potential eventuality that would follow an Israeli incursion into Rafah, and I think Israel has made it very clear to the Egyptians that we are going to help them prevent that from happening, not that we are so committed not to allow Palestinians to go to Egypt, but we understand their sensitivities and we are going to take them into our considerations and make sure that this is not the case. I can understand their fear, but we are going to be determined to help them avoid this eventuality.
Keeping in the Rafah, there's reports that the American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff presented the Israeli Ramatkal Halevi with a proposal about how the military should go into Rafah, pretty much limiting what Israeli army can do. Saying it should be, Israeli army should be using sensors and cameras, and just do very strategic, focused raids and not a total takeover of Rafah. Is this feasible?
Again, feasible, but not not satisfactory. We need to uproot Hamas from Rafah. And, that cannot be done in the way proposed by the Americans. And what the Americans are proposing would leave Hamas in control of Rafah, which means it would leave Hamas in control of the population of Gaza and would leave Hamas in power. This is unacceptable from an Israeli point of view. Our goal is to make sure that Hamas is not functioning as the ruler of Gaza anymore and is unable to launch terror attacks from Gaza. And this cannot be achieved through the means proposed by the American general.
So the way that you could, as a former general, can see, envision the battle would be to move the population again out of Rafah, having to another place, right?
Yes. We should move them north of Rafah. Unlike what people think, there is enough space in Gaza to host these people for a short while. It's, we don't mean to make them leave there forever. But they will have to move outside of Rafah for a while. And then we should be able to carry out a military operation in Rafah and take care of the four battalions of Hamas that are still deployed in the Rafah area. And once we do that, we shall be able to say that we have completed taking over all of Gaza. Well, we still have some pockets here and there in the Deir al-Balah and Nusayrat. Okay, we'll have to take care of them too. But Rafah is the main area that we haven't dealt with until now with ground operation. And we have to do that and also take responsibility for all of Gaza and make sure that everybody in Gaza knows that Hamas is out of business and it's not coming back. That the most important thing is to make sure that everybody knows that they are not coming back. And all the ideas that are short of that are not good enough from an Israeli point of view, are not good enough also from the point of view of the Palestinian population. Because this would make the suffering longer and there would be no solution to this problem if we leave the situation as it is now. So it's, we need to take Gaza over, to take Rafah over, not only for the sake of the Israeli security, but also for the sake of the Palestinians living in Gaza.
Reserve Brigadier General Yossi Kupavasa. Attorney General Gali Baharav Meira has informed the Defence Ministry and the Education Ministry that the process of drafting members of the ultra-Orthodox community into the army must begin immediately. She also warned against any attempts to continue funding yeshivas that harbour students who dodge their army service against court orders. In a letter to legal advisers for both ministries, Baharav Meira and Deputy Attorney General Gil Lemon noted that the state needs to tell the High Court of Justice by the end of the month what steps it is taking to draft the Haredi community. We spoke with Professor Benny Brown from Jerusalem's Hebrew University and the Israel Democracy Institute and asked him about the ultra-Orthodox response to the draft decision and the cutting of funds to the yeshivas.
Most of the Haredim were quite shocked by it. Although it was quite expected for a long time, the government succeeded in prolonging the process and postponing the court decision from already a few years. And actually, when it already came, it was quite shocking for many of them. However, it's noteworthy that the Supreme Court did not decide on forceful, coercive recruitment of the Haredi yeshiva students, but rather budget cuts for their institutions. And that is kind of what we spoke about when planning the possible ways to recruit Haredim. There are two channels. One channel was the personal sanctions, some of them even criminal sanctions, such as imprisonment and the like. And others are the institutional sanctions, and this is what actually the Supreme Court opted for. So basically, this is less severe in the social, the sense of the social rift in Israel, because we won't see military or police forces coming to arrest Haredim. We will just see a kind of reorganization of the Haredi institutions in attempt to gain their funding from other sources, which is something quite more bearable for them. They always said that most of their budgets are not from the state, and it will, of course, offend them and be a painful decrease in their incomes. But still, it's not something that will absolutely dry them up out. So they'll have to seek other sources of financing. And that is indeed a problem, because already now most of these institutions are their existence is on a quite low level in terms of material resources. But this is something that is more easy to overcome, more easy to surmount than personal sanctions, certainly than criminal sanctions. So they're still in shock. They still can't really accept this fact, but they can find some solace, we can say, in the fact that it is not the most severe sanction that was on the table.
Theoretically, there is, of course, another month to reach some kind of compromise before the High Court meets again on the issue. Do you think that's possible? Do you think there is wriggle room for an agreement that will please the Haredi community and some members of the Likud who feel very strongly about this, and the judicial branch as well? Is it doable?
I think that such a compromise will be only a compromise that will not hurt what they consider, the Haredim consider, as the hard core of the yeshiva world, which is, if it's something that only recruits, you know, some kinds of marginal numbers and people who are already on the margins in sense of their Haredi commitment, that would be something more bearable for them. I doubt whether it would be sufficient for the Supreme Court, because basically we have to say the truth in that issue. Now, for example, in the Zionist religious movement, we can see a kind of overall mobilization for the campaign against the Haredim, that calling to the Haredim to join the army. But the problem is indeed severe. I mean, it's we speak about it all the time in terms of equal burden, things like that. But from the Haredim's point of view, it's a matter of freedom of conscience, we can call it. We usually keep, you know, our vocabulary changes when we speak about different sectors in the society. When it's leftist, we speak about freedom of conscience. With the Haredim, we speak about equal burden. But for the Haredim, it's a problem of freedom of conscience, because for them, recruitment to the army draft is actually a means for their secularization. And they don't want to be secularized. And when the religious Zionists call and say, look at us, we can keep our religious commitment and still serve in the army and take part in the Israeli society and its duties, this is exactly what they don't want. They don't want to be like the Zionist religious. They treat them with some degradation, sometimes even contempt. They don't want to be like them. So even if the army goes a few more miles toward the Haredim, it won't meet their demands and their high standards of religious observance.
According to some commentators, there is some willingness after the terrible events of October the 7th amongst some of the Haredi population, an acceptance that what was cannot be anymore. But it's the rabbis that are taking a hardline position, blocking any potential compromise. Is that the case?
Those who think that something has changed. First of all, I think the entire Israeli society is no longer in that mood. Most of the Israeli society, left and right, actually returned to the rift and the conflicts that preceded the October 7th. So the Haredim are not different in that sense. They were all shocked, were all united, solidified, in, you can say, under the trauma, but that we were kind of recovering in the bad sense of the word and returning to our earlier conflicts. Nothing changed in the depth of the Israeli society's internal rift. So Haredim are no different. And those who already were on the margin, that's what I said in my previous answer, that those who are already in a certain kind of limbo on the margins of the Haredi society are willing to regret it. Most of them did. These are only a few thousands. This didn't satisfy the Supreme Court and many others who demand the equal burden from the Haredi. I think they won't suffice with that either. If these numbers are grow a little bit, they want something much more substantive. Sorry, in terms of Haredi recruitment. So I believe that they could have met somewhere in the middle if the recruitment would be on those Haredim. But I don't think it will satisfy the Supreme Court.
And what about within the ultra-Orthodox community? Is there any difference between the Ashkenazi parties and Shas on this issue?
Yes, there are. But still, the internal dynamics of the Haredi world is such that the more stringent position is more influential, and others do not want to be portrayed as lukewarm, as not committed enough. Basically, Shas as well doesn't want the military draft. And if they do agree to compromises, it's because it is a little more lenient and more aiming at, first of all, wants to keep the present coalition. That is one interest that is important to all the Haredim. But also they understand that they won't get any better government in the future, and they do want to reach the compromise within this political framework. So Shas is a little more pragmatic in that sense. It also doesn't have a rabbinic leadership, not exactly in the strict sense of the word as the other parties, the Agudat Israel and the Degel Torah have. So it's easier for us, people like us, politicians like Aryeh Deri, to be pragmatic rather than the other Ashkenazi leaders who are much more subject to the rabbinic leadership, which, as you said correctly, is a little more kind of rigid in this dispute.
Finally, last night, a few hundred members of the Brothers and Sisters in Arms protest organization decided to march in Mea Shearim in Jerusalem. How did this go down?
Yes, actually, it's a provocation, it's clear. Mea Shearim is the most radical Haredi ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, the most anti-Zionist, the center of the anti-Zionist circles today. Those who do not only fight against the recruitment, but also many of them refuse to get government financing. So in that respect, it was even kind of absurd, you know, that they went there in order to convince them to be recruited when they for them the sanctions imposed by the Supreme Court are already there from their own choice. They didn't take government financing by their own choice. So to convince them, it's even more ridiculous. And it is clear that they didn't come not to they come to convince anyone, but actually kind of evoke. Resistance and evoke ugly responses, and they didn't get it so much. They did get, I mean, antagonistic reactions, but no outburst of, you know, of violence or anything like it happened there. So I think in that respect, it was a missed provocation, a kind of unsuccessful provocation.
Professor Benny Brown from Jerusalem's Hebrew University and the Israel Democracy Institute. Thanks for listening. This is Mark Weiss wishing you Shavua Tov from Jerusalem. And we end with Matis Yahu with Ascent.
My fam under attack. We used to getting shot in the back, and now the whack, they wanna understand. Stiff neck, son of the right hand, a fam of slaves from the sand. Just a dreamer in a foreign land. Yeah, you know we smart and mad funny. To come against the first sons, you must be a dummy. The curse the blessed one, son, you're going wrong. And it won't take long, for I'm dancing on your headstone. You're still captive to the poison all around you. Infected brain, no one to blame but the Jew. Jew, are you insane? This is not new. They've been saying this for years. Cry babies with their fears. We control the industry and everything around you. It's not a conspiracy, I'm sorry, but it's true. The only thing that brings us together is you. When the crazy motherfucker got his finger on the trigger, and also Twitter, we've lost the whole litter. So why are you bitter? Just a few escaping, yes, we rose quicker. And our blood runs thicker. Our stars shine brighter than a swastika. And our candle still flickers. And that's the one that's all around you. You found your vision in a candle. Sunsetting in the early afternoon. I sweep the demon out my room. I got a throne for that. I got the boom in the back. I got room to take naps and come back. But all this chat, it got me running like I'm Judah Mack. But I've been up and down this ladder while you staring at the same face. Like Jake, I climbed the staircase. And why these idols get replaced with the angels who rep the face of a nation that could never be erased. We re-up, resurface, and we relocate. When our fate comes into evil men who take. Some are burned in the oven, others on the stake. Tell me, could you relate when the powerful feel fake? Jealousy's an evil snake. But it's an ancient mistake, and we had time to ponder. We wonder about the thunder of German chains rolling over Polish landscapes. What does it take to be a nation of slaves? Deprived not to pray, we rise from the grave. Fight waves of deniers who say liars start fires that blaze. But truth is the water that stands in its way. And that's the one that's all around you. You found your vision in a candle. Running like I'm Judah Max. He is at my life's best.
תדע לשקר לאדמה את כל כאביי, את לילותיי, את ימיי. עולם מולו נחמותי אדמה, ואנו עצי השדה אדמה. תדע לשקר אדמה את כל כאביי.